In a time where capitalism, COVID, and white supremacy threaten all life on Earth, I was honored to be joined by guest Dr. Robert Nichols to discuss his groundbreaking book, Theft is Property, Dispossession and Critical Theory. Our conversation is a wide-ranging tour and critique of traditionally Eurocentric and white interpretations of Marxism, anarchism, and liberal bourgeois capitalism, putting them in dialogue and debate with indigenous concepts of property, freedom, and society. It's a fascinating conversation that turns property, capitalism, and other hegemonies that we take as reality on their head and shows us the other side of what the world could be. One in harmony with nature, one where property is communal, and one where we are able to build communities rather than focus on societies built around the notion of the individual and individual ownership. Again, this was an honor to speak with Dr. Nichols. It is, in my opinion, one of the most important conversations I've had. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog on the Arts of Travel podcast to hear other conversations with seminal thinkers like Dr. Joy James, as well as a host of writers, artists, and thinkers I find truly revolutionary. Here's my conversation now with Dr. Robert Nichols on his book, Theft is Property, Dispossession and Critical Theory. I hope you enjoy our conversation today. For print interviews, you can check out asiaarttours.com as well.
Robert Nichols. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, and I teach political theory and the history of political thought.
So why we're having this conversation today is off a book I found to be enormously helpful. It's your book, Theft is Property, which looks at issues of dispossession, indigenous land back demands, how laws and settler colonialism are intertwined, Marxism, and a whole bunch of other fascinating issues that progressive and leftist and Marxist and anarchist thinkers have been wrestling with for centuries, but oftentimes through the work of other white authors. Your book is a very refreshing antidote, similar to the recently released Dawn of Everything by David Graeber and David Wengrow, of trying to center indigenous perspectives on some of these issues. So to start, I wanted to ask if you could discuss a little bit about the title of your book, what it means, because it's a very rich theoretical lens throughout your book that you use this notion of theft is property. And how does this lens allow us to better understand dispossession and land back demands compared to how traditionally an anarchist, a Marxist, or maybe just a progressive, well-minded liberal might think about property or the nation state?
Sure, thank you. So the title of the book, Theft is Property, is a kind of play off of an old slogan. Classical anarchists in the 19th century used to use the slogan, property is theft. In the French context in particular, la propriété, c'est le vol. And I think that emerged kind of out of two general issues that were raised by anarchists in the 19th century. Anarchism at the time was kind of the most dominant, most important and influential leftist strand of radical thought, much more so than Marxism, at least through to the late 19th century. And the two big issues that the anarchists were raising at the time had to do with property. The first was that feudalism was criticized by anarchists, and not only anarchists, but particularly by them, on the basis of the idea that feudal systems were propagated through a kind of exclusive monopoly over the ownership of land, which was held by the aristocracy. So basically, only aristocrats could effectively own underlying title to the land. And that meant that the vast majority of people were essentially born into permanent renter status. As soon as you were born, if you were a commoner, you were already kind of in arrears, and you'd spend your whole life trying, in effect, to pay the lords what you owed them for the privilege of living on their land. And anarchists, you know, just raised the question, well, how did these nobility get the ownership claim to the underlying land in the first place? Where did it come from? And that's where they basically made the argument that it was just a massive act of theft, that the aristocracy had essentially stolen the underlying title to the land from the vast majority of people. And that's how they had consolidated this monopoly over landed property. So property is theft was a slogan there as a way of trying to illustrate that the landed property, the underlying title to the earth, has been effectively transferred from the vast majority of people to this small group of aristocrats. But anarchists also kind of tried to make a more exaggerated claim, a more radical claim, which was that all kinds of property, by extension, were also illegitimate. So not just landed property or what we call real estate, but also chattel property, so like movable property, just ordinary wealth. The fact that there is inequalities in kind of money and other kinds of financial assets, they argued, was in effect a downstream effect of this original expropriation or dispossession of the earth. So they're trying to make this really radical claim that all property forms, even in chattel or movable property, are illegitimate because they derive from this original act of theft. And one of the things that interests me is that argument and how that argument travels or translates into other contexts or not. And one of the things that I'm interested in was how when Marxism kind of arose, and Marx in particular initially, although not exclusively him, they started to criticize this classical anarchist tradition. And they did so saying basically that when someone says that property is theft, what they're doing is actually committing themselves to a contradictory claim. Because if we say that property is theft, we are in a sense already presuming some notion of property. In other words, you can't complain that people are the victims of a massive act of theft unless you can prove that those people were the actual owners to begin with. So the Marxists tried to make the argument that the classical anarchist argument was kind of contradictory. So in part of the point of the book is to just look at some of those debates, to reconstruct them for us, and to ask, first of all, how in what ways they might be relevant to the present. But more specifically, I'm interested in how those kinds of debates and discussions might be useful for thinking through questions of colonialism. Because in context of colonial acquisition, indigenous peoples also seem to sometimes make arguments that sound, at least on the surface, like those classical anarchist arguments. Indigenous people say something like, the earth has also been stolen from us. And the point of the book really is to try to show that although superficially their arguments seem very similar to those classical anarchist ones, their use of these terms is a little bit different. And it's different because they're trying to demonstrate that it isn't just a matter of transferring ownership from one group of people to another. So it's not just like stealing an object from one party and transferring it to another party. It's also changing the nature of the relationship to the object. So in effect, it's converting a non-propertied relationship into a propertied one. But at the same time as that is taking place, it's transferring control of the newly created property object from one party to another. So it's kind of combining propertyization with systematic acquisition or theft. And if that's true, then theft, this really complicated form of theft, is actually the process that's making the property object. So it's kind of backwards from how we'd normally think about it. And in order to reflect that, I try to just invert the classical anarchist phrase. Instead of saying property is theft, I say theft is property, because I'm trying to point to a very particular process by which property relationships are generated through the act of stealing.
So some of the most clear and I think powerful examples of how some of these dynamics of how settler colonialism transformed property, property relations, and why this is was irreconcilable with many indigenous societies comes from Aotearoa, forgive my pronunciation, also known as New Zealand. And in particular, Maori documentation of wars with colonialists, of eventual coming to some sort of accommodation, but it's hard to call it an accommodation when it's at the barrel of a gun, with settler colonialism. So this is what you write about Aotearoa and Maori concepts of property, as well as why these concepts of property, viewing property, adjudicating property, settling property disputes were so frustrating to British colonialists. So this is from your book. A particular Maori person could not own a discrete and distinct zone of space over which they could exercise exclusive control. Instead, property rights were traditionally allocated on a functional basis. Individuals, or as was more common, families, could claim a proprietary interest to a certain kind of activity within a circumscribed context. For example, a right to fish from this stream or collect fruit from that tree at this time of year, and so on. Moreover, since there were typically since they were typically apportioned based on familial lineages, recitation of genealogy was more important to the reconstruction of one's property rights than British geospatial techniques of enclosure, fencing, and mapping. British colonists of the period frequently expressed frustration at their inability to grasp the myriad interlay of proprietary claims within a single space, and in particular, the difficulty in bundling them together so as to acquire total control over all objects and activities within a single zone of space. As E.G. Wakefield complained to a committee of the House of Commons, the right of individual property has never existed in New Zealand. So this is a question that I think I find absolutely fascinating. How were Maori property disputes resolved in ways that perhaps would be unfamiliar to those of us who've lived in settler colonial systems of jurisprudence? And why is the settler colonial legal system of jurisprudence, at least in New Zealand or more broadly for Indigenous communities, unable or unwilling to find concepts, to find compromise with Maori or Indigenous concepts of property?
Sure. So it's a big and complex question. So let me try to give my sense of it. The first thing I can say is, so I'm not an expert on the Maori in particular, and particularly not an expert on sort of pre-colonial, pre-contact Maori practices. So you'd have to sort of ask someone who is more an expert specifically on Maori traditions and practices to know precisely how property disputes were resolved before colonization. But I can give a kind of general gloss on my understanding of it based on the work that I build on in the book, with a greater focus more on the kind of interaction between the Maori system and the British. So for to do that, kind of let take a step back, first of all, just try to think a little bit very generally about, like, what do we mean when we're talking about property? What is property? Well, in a kind of very general sense, property is a term that's used to describe a really diverse array of relationships. But they're usually relationships between people that have to do with exclusion, that is, the ability to kind of like exclude other people from use and acquisition and enjoyment of certain objects or things in the world. So for example, if I say I have property in my house, what I really mean is that I have an enforceable right to exclude other people from access and use and enjoyment of that house. Now, at this really general level of kind of abstraction, probably all human societies have property relations. There are no human societies that have no ways of regulating use and access and enjoyment of the objects and things of the earth, right? So kind of at a very general level, indigenous peoples clearly have property relations of various sorts. They have legal systems and norms and regulations and kind of normative or traditional understandings of what is an appropriate or inappropriate use of this or that thing. But what a lot of indigenous peoples and just generally a lot of societies around the world and even European societies at other times in history, what they have not done is taken all of the different kinds of relationships that we could have to different objects and sort of creatures and living things like trees and streams and the natural resources beneath the soil and the topsoil itself and the water that flows through it. And what many societies have not done is tried to bundle all of those complex relationships and assign them as if there was one overarching property claim to the space itself. And that's in a sense what we mean in the European tradition when we talk about landed property. Because when we talk about landed property, we're really talking about the idea of kind of bundling all the different property relations that are possible in a given space so that those can be all transferred all at once. So that one person can, in a sense, own the zone or space. And that's what we're exchanging when we sell a piece of land. Now, when British colonists arrived in New Zealand, they realized that the Maori did not traditionally bundle property in land in this way. And that meant it wasn't possible for the British to purchase or acquire the land directly. They kind of initially would have all these agreements and they'd enter into negotiations and make agreements with Maori people over property rights, but they would quickly find that they had only acquired a right to this thing, you know, like I said in the quote that you mentioned, the right to fish from this stream during the spring or the right to collect fruit from the tree. And so someone else kept showing up and using the same land at different periods of time or with respect to different kinds of resources in that space. And so the British were frustrated by this, right? They realized that the Maori there was no way for them to kind of acquire underlying title to the land because there wasn't this notion that land was something in which anyone could have a kind of general exclusive proprietary claim to. So one thing that they tried to do kind of paradoxically is to actually ascribe that idea to the Maori, to say, oh, that the Maori must have some kind of, you know, notions to land. But the main purpose of ascribing it to them wasn't to defend the Maori interest in the land, but to defend the British interest in acquiring that property right. So they'd say, okay, the Maori have this insofar as they're able to transfer it to us. So a couple things are happening in that moment, right? First of all, it's changing the nature of the kind of right. It's no longer a right to use something, like a right to fish from a stream or a right to pick fruit from a tree, which is a use right. It's turned it into an underlying ownership right. That is, a person doesn't just have a right to like fish from the stream, but if someone has the ownership of the stream itself. So it's transferring it from a kind of use right to an ownership right. Second thing is it's transferring it from a complex diversity of different relationships to different things and bundling that in the legal kind of concept of land. So it's not just changing the kind of right, it's changing the object in which the right is invested. And one of the things that that also does, one of the byproducts of it, is it changes how you map and regulate and keep track of who has this right, like who ultimately owns the thing in question. In the Maori system, because it was so connected to use of a diverse array of relationships, you had to have a very high level of knowledge about the particular relationships. You'd have to really know a lot about that particular landscape in order to know who had all of these different kinds of use rights. So it had a kind of very high threshold of knowledge. A person would have to live in that space for quite a long time for them to understand all of the diverse relationships and all of the different kinds of proprietary claims. And that's why for the Maori, it was very connected to their family lineages. And the so testing, okay, if you claim you have a property right in, say, this tree, we would know this by your ability to actually recite how that was acquired, what's your family lineage, how did your family acquire this, and so on. In other words, it's a very thick, intimate, long-standing relationship that has been built up over time, which proves a person's claim. Now, the British system, as it kind of bundled those claims and started to attach them more to the land itself and to this kind of geospatial grid, it also makes it more abstract. Because now, when it's all bundled together, it can just be recorded in a ledger somewhere. And so it's very much a part of a process of disembedding the relationships and codifying them into a kind of a ledger system. The British had something called title by registration. So there'd be like an office somewhere you could go and look up the registry and you could see who owned all of the land, right? And everybody's now familiar with this idea. You can look at like a map and see a grid and it's all into little blocks and squares and you can see who owns which space and you can purchase it from that person. Now the important part about that is that as it gets more and more abstracted and becomes part of this ledger system, it makes it a lot easier to transfer. It can become commodified. Because a total outsider who knows nothing about the space, maybe someone who's never visited it before, someone who lives in England, can try to purchase it, right? They can buy that square of land from a distance and they don't need to know anything about, you know, when the fish are spawning or anything like that, because what they are acquiring is this abstract kind of spatial unit. So many different things are happening in that process, right? It's turning it from a use into an ownership claim. It's turning it from the relationships to the specific animals and creatures and you know, natural resources into a claim about the underlying land or the geospatial grid. And it's turning it from a deep relationship that is sort of performed over a long period of time through knowledge into an abstraction and a commodity. And that's why there is a deep irreconcilability between these two systems. They're not just two people claiming the same object. It's two very different ways of thinking about property. And the two systems come into conflict with one another. And that's part of what I tried to grasp in that section of the book.
Another idea that you raise in the book is looking at how Indigenous scholars have interacted with Marx's work over the years, as well as international scholars coming from non-Anglo-Saxon colonized countries, as well as those who've unfortunately had to endure colonization at the hands of Anglo-Saxon empires. In writing about Marx's primitive accumulation and some of the critiques or augmentation that these experts have looked into, you write the following. Among the myriad complexities of these debates, two matters stand out most prominently. One, is primitive accumulation best thought of as a historical stage of capitalist development or as a distinct modality of its ongoing operation? Two, Does the supposed silent compulsion characteristic of capitalist exploitation constitutionally depend on the continual injection of extra economic violence? The first is about the relation between the general law of accumulation and primitive accumulation. The second refers to the forms of violence they imply. From Marx's own later writings through to Luxembourg, Guha, Federici, and Coulthard, Glenn Coulthard there, and much of the critical geography framework, this has generally been resolved by shifting the temporal framework provided in Capital to a spatial one. We are no longer operating with a distinction between mature capital and its prehistory, but with a distinction between core and periphery, colonizer and the colonized. So this is a time where global indigenous communities from the Wet'suwet'en to Aotearoa to Mauna Kea, who we'll discuss, I think, later again, are seeking to protect land from, to paraphrase the great Marxist Ruth Wilson Gilmore, state-sanctioned death. So how does Marx's original vision of primitive accumulation fail to account for the contemporary violence we see in capitalism? And what work has this global network of scholars, both indigenous and non-white, done in helping to critique, augment, or otherwise surpass how Marx saw primitive accumulation as a stage of development in capitalism?
Let me start, by just saying a few words then about just the term primitive accumulation, and then try to talk a little bit about how it's been kind of stretched and extrapolated by others, and then finally my own kind of particular take on this. So the term primitive accumulation is used by Marx in the last section of volume one of Capital, Das Kapital, but it's not Marx's own phrase. He gets it from Adam Smith. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations talks about the original accumulation of stock. So Smith is talking about kind of, in order to set up a business or set up some enterprise, a person has to first gather together all of the kind of things that you need in order to get the business up off the ground. You know, you need the furniture and the building and so on. So there's all this stuff that you have to acquire before you get your business started. And obviously you can't use in a normal case, you have to acquire all that stuff from some resources that are not themselves the product of the business. Right? The business is going to be making you money down the road, you still need some initial investment money. So maybe you get a loan or something like that. So Smith uses this idea of the original accumulation of stock to describe the original process of acquiring the stuff that you need in order to set up a capitalist enterprise. In the last sections of Capital, Marx, in a sense, takes on Smith and other classical political economists like David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, and he criticizes them because he basically argues that they can't really explain how capitalists in the first place gathered this stock. Where did it come from? It couldn't come from them purchasing it with money, because that's the very thing we're trying to explain, is how did they get money in the first place? So that would just kind of push it back one further step, right? And Marx's basic argument in that section is that when you look to the actual history, the actual historical process by which capitalism emerged, the main primary way in which capitalists as a class acquired this original accumulation of stock is through force. They got it through violence. Specifically, they actually use the apparatus of the state. State power is used in order to forcibly seize control over these assets. And that's the secret history of capitalism, which these classical political economists are so eager to hide. So Marx then tries to go on to defend that claim empirically, to just try to show actually historically, you know, that's actually how it got started. So primitive accumulation is usually used by Marxists then to describe the historical process of setting up capitalism in the first place. Like, how did capitalism emerge from feudalism, from pre-capitalist relationships? And to highlight in particular the sort of enormous violence of force that's required in order to set this up. Now, it's kind of a controversial claim, or historically it's been controversial, because at least on one reading, it sounds like once you get the capital relationship going, once you have people who are bosses and employers, and then you have people who are wage labor workers, you no longer need to use overt state violence in order to compel workers to come to work. You just put a sign in the window and say, you know, work for offer, and people will come willingly, right? And of course they do so because they have to. At that stage, once it all gets going, people are sort of self-conscript into wage labor because they need wages in order to survive. So it sounds like the period of open force and violence fades away over historical time as we get into mature capitalist relations. And at one point, Marx says that the extra economic, that is state violence of capitalism, fades away and is replaced by what he calls the silent compulsion of exploitation. Now that's controversial, right? Because although it, in historical time, if you look at kind of the development of Western Europe, it looks like the violence that's required to set up capitalism does fade away and becomes more about this silent compulsion in Western Europe. But at the same time that that historical process is taking place over time, those societies are expanding outward spatially, right? Western European societies aren't just staying contained to Western Europe, they're spreading and they're going outward. And as they're going outward around the globe through colonization and imperialism, they're encountering other non-capitalist societies. And so they're using this enormous force and violence to restructure those societies and to turn them into capitalist societies through imperialist domination. So some people have argued that primitive accumulation shouldn't be used to describe just the historical stage by which European societies transitioned from pre-capitalism into capitalism, but should also be used to describe the imperial expansion process at the periphery. So primitive accumulation then is used to name two different things, right? This historical emergence process and the spatial expansion process. My concern with that, I think that's very, you know, useful and helpful, and it's a good way of connecting how capitalist expansion reproduces violent relationships elsewhere at its kind of periphery. My primary concern with this sort of general theory that primitive accumulation could be used to describe these two things is that it can at times be a little bit misleading about the impact that these processes have on different populations. And in my context, the primary context that I'm concerned with, the reason is that when we talk about primitive accumulation in Western Europe, we are looking at how people are dispossessed of their lands. So it sounds kind of superficially similar to indigenous peoples being dispossessed of their lands, like what happened to the Irish, or what happened to the Ulster Scots in northern parts of Great Britain. Those people were also sort of pushed off their lands. But when those people were pushed off their lands, they were pushed into proletarianized relationships. So in Europe, there was dispossession that led to proletarianization. People were pushed off their lands and their communal relationships to land and driven into wage labor relationships. But those people didn't just stay put in Western Europe. As European societies expanded, they had these then surplus laboring populations, all these poor Irishmen and Scotsmen and so on. And what they did is they exported them abroad. And in the English-speaking world in particular, they exported these poor, dispossessed workers into English settler colonies. Huge numbers of Irish and Scotsmen and so on were relocated to places like Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. And because they were relocated into those other places, there was a surplus of this poor in laboring population. And because there was a surplus of incoming white waged workers, it rendered indigenous labor superfluous, right? You didn't need to proletarianize the indigenous people. You didn't need to exploit them as workers because you were importing huge amounts of workers. In the United States, this is even more exaggerated because also of the massive importing of enslaved labor. So the labor problem has a different configuration in those places than it does in Western Europe. And that means that indigenous peoples, because they're not primarily targeted for the exploitation of their work, they are primarily targeted for removal and displacement, right? They're rendered sort of superfluous to the labor process. As a result, in the Anglo settler colonies, we have something like dispossession without proletarianization, right? We have this process of pushing people off the land, but not in order to turn them into workers, but rather in order to just simply get rid of them so that you can import other workers from elsewhere. That, I think, is not easily captured by just talking more generically about primitive accumulation. I think you need to talk a little more specifically about this phenomenon that I'm calling dispossession without proletarianization. I think that lots of Marxists have been primarily concerned, I mean, the sort of standard thing, right, in Marxism is to be primarily concerned with exploitation, waged labor relationships, and class domination. As a result, Marxists have been less focused historically on forms of violence and dispossession that don't produce waged labor workers, that don't lead to exploitation. And that's part of my answer as to why contemporary Marxists have generally been less interested in settler colonization and indigenous peoples' resistance, because that hasn't revolved primarily around the question of labor, but instead has primarily revolved around the question of land.
And that's probably why I've not been interested in most traditional Marxist scholarship as well.
Yeah, well, it's something that's been criticized from other angles by feminists, for instance, who are also interested in non-waged workers or other kinds of non-Western, even non-Western Marxists, right? Who have, like Maoism and so on, is centrally concerned with peasantry and or Marxism in Latin America, centrally concerned with indigenous peoples. It's primarily European Marxism that's really focused so centrally on the kind of industrial proletariat as its kind of main focus.
Well, the next question is about solidarity. I think as an inverse to what we just discussed, just as an aside, I find it enormously valuable when Marxism is reflected in these other contexts, like indigenous criticisms, criticisms from non-Western or countries that had to endure colonialism and so on. You talk in terms of the solidarity that was built to fight settler colonialism as indigenous, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this word and you can correct me in your answer, syncretism. How indigenous groups came together from radically different backgrounds, traditions, beliefs, and so on, in an attempt to push back against the all-encompassing absorption and violence that came from settler colonies. You write, indigeneity is a politics, a contested terrain of discursive and material struggle that simultaneously unites and divides people as individuals and collectives. Now, for me, and you do bring up Black feminism in your book as well, this brings to mind, for me, the work of the Black feminist Joy James, and how she's often looked at how Black freedom struggles have been built by individuals that connect groups from very different perspectives, as well as how within that politics of Black revolution, there are what you mentioned in your book, accommodationists, those who seek to work within the status quo, as well as revolutionaries. An accommodationist might be, in my mind, a Kamala Harris, whereas a revolutionary might be an Assata Shakur or Ella Baker. Some very prominent indigenous struggles have happened recently with Iomatao, Mauna Kea, Okinawa, the Wedzin Kwa, and other contemporary struggles. I'm wondering how this notion of indigenous syncretism and indigeneity as politics, how has that played out at a pan-national level between some of these different movements? And do we also see this tension that you bring up, that in my mind, Joy James brings up, between accommodationists and revolutionaries in these movements?
Sure, yeah. I mean, again, another big kind of important question or set of issues, really. So a lot of times when I talk about these things and when we look at these different movements globally, people immediately ask, how should we think about, if, especially for those of us, myself included, who are not Indigenous, how do we think about solidarity with Indigenous people? In other words, how do we think about the relationships between Indigenous peoples and non-Indigenous peoples? And obviously that's very different depending on whether the non-Indigenous community is white or new immigrant communities or Black communities, but however defined and described, the question of solidarity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples is, you know, continuously coming up in the context of these important struggles over land. And the first thing I point out, and I try to discuss a little bit in the book, is that Indigenous politics is itself already a long historical process of building solidarity. It's not that Indigenous peoples firstly understood themselves first and foremost as Indigenous. Like, the concept of indigeneity is itself the product of a long process of building solidarity across social, cultural, economic, and linguistic differences. When Europeans, of course, first came and started to colonize North America, the peoples that they encountered didn't, of course, call themselves Indigenous or identify primarily as Indigenous. They identified by their distinctive national and linguistic and political forms of self-organization. So they, you know, they called themselves the Haudenosaunee or the Pequot or the Inuits, the Cherokee, right? There were these different distinct traditions, and there were rivalries and competition between the different groups, right? The Haudenosaunee and the Wendat have a longstanding kind of rivalry, or the, where I'm living now, the kind of conflict between the Ojibwe and the Ochetishakowin or the Great Sioux Nation. So that these nations and communities have longstanding rivalries and competitions with one another. But slowly through the process of coming to encounter a shared threat and a shared external power in the form of European colonization, through an extremely protracted period of political negotiation and solidarity building and organizing, they came to supplement the distinct linguistic and ethnocultural and national identifications with a broader trans-political or a sort of transnational form of identification called indigeneity. So the examples that you just listed are from New Zealand and Hawaii and Canada. Why and how is it that we have come to describe, you know, the Maori in New Zealand and say the Cree in Canada, or the Coast Salish, or the Diné in the United States? How have we come to describe all of these people as Indigenous? Well, that's partially because they have been targeted similarly by a similar kind of process, but also because they've worked extremely hard to build these transnational forms of solidarity. Now, of course, they still have their local national identifications, their Indigenous nation-specific forms of politics, but they have supplemented them, as I say, with this kind of global transnational indigeneity politics. So my first response to the question, how do we build solidarity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples is to say, well, let's look at how Indigenous peoples within them, their own communities built this initial form of transnational indigeneity as a political form. And I think one of the ways that they did that was to try to identify a set of goals and values and objectives, and then to re-articulate their identity categories in relation to those goals. So rather than say, you know, we are, you know, Cherokee or Chickasaw only to the exclusion of all other people who are not Cherokee or Chickasaw, they began to ask the question, who shares our values? And who's willing to actually struggle in order to bring those values about? And all of those people, we can build alliances and solidarities with. So there's a kind of bootstrapping process by which you articulate your goals, your values, and then you re-articulate in expanded form the identity categories that are attached to that political process. So part of what I just try to look at in the book is like how that actually happened over a long period of time, of course. And then the point of looking at that is not just, I'm not a historian, so I'm not just interested in the backward-looking description of like what actually happened, but rather because of, I'm interested in drawing out the lessons from that process for the present, right? How we can think about this as an ongoing thing that's continuing up to and including today. As you say, one complication with that is that every community is itself internally divided. There are no human communities, no political communities that are, you know, perfectly unified. There's always stratification and internal differentiation. And that includes the emergence of kind of class elites within communities. So there's always an internal tradition of critique as well that's concerned with how the process can produce elites who then try to reconcile their society with existing power relations by accommodating themselves to it. So we look at that tradition then of critique of the accommodationists. How did these societies deal with that? How do they think about that? How do they respond to their own people, other indigenous people, who were arguing we should effectively just assimilate to the United States? You know, those people have existed, but the radical critique was to demonstrate not that those accommodationists were sort of just crazy or co-opted or whatever, but that they, on very important sort of empirical grounds, were incorrect in thinking that was in the long run going to be a healthy way to live. So they tried to leverage alternative normative arguments, like what kind of life do we want to live? Do we want to live under this system of exploitation and domination? Are we interested simply in getting a little bit more money out of a generally exploitative and unsustainable form of development? Well, the kind of more radical strands of those traditions definitely usually come up with the answer that no, we're both critical of colonialism and capitalist exploitation of our resources and lands, but we're also not merely interested in a slightly bigger portion of the pie. We actually have a more radical, a deeper criticism of that. And so that's part of what I try to look at in the book, is just that long history of that process.
Robert, this has been a fascinating conversation. I am going to stop myself on this last question, because otherwise I think I'll have to either be your TA or do some grading for you, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. This is, a two-part question. It looks at, I think, the optimistic ending, or at least the how you highlight that there are tools that are available even in our bleak present for trying to slowly take back, I think, a more healthy relationship with the land than the one we have now under global capitalism and in many countries, nation states built upon ethno-supremacy and genocide. So you write on Indigenous engagement with law and rights within nation states that are settler colonial. Although Te Uera is not alone in 2000, and this is in New Zealand, although unique, Te Uera is not alone. In 2017, it was joined by two other non-human legal persons. Mount Taranaki, a stunning 2,518-meter tall volcanic cone mountain, and Whanganui, the third largest river in Aotearoa. In the course of debates over the status of the river, Gerald Alberta, lead negotiator for the Whanganui Iwi, explained their position. The reason we have taken this approach is because we consider the river an ancestor and always have. We have fought to find an approximation in law so that others can understand that from our perspective, treating the river as a living entity is the correct way to approach it, as an indivisible whole, instead of the traditional model of the last 100 years of treating it from the perspective of ownership and management. So in terms of, that's the end of the quote, and I wanted to end with this. I think for a lot of my listeners, land back would be a phrase many would know of, at least in a very novice way associated with Indigenous resistance. Could you discuss a bit about how this approach of working within the law maybe is one way to approach land back politics? And where have you and other scholars perhaps seen the need to augment these approaches of working within the law of settler colonial nation states with more radical approaches to resistance as it comes to land back? And if you feel it's helpful to explain land back in general, particularly through your research, you're more than welcome to.
Sure, thank you. So land back is a kind of slogan, a broad slogan that refers to a whole host of movements really across the world that are interested in changing the register of Indigenous politics away from the more conciliatory negotiation-based kind of approach, especially the kind of recognition-based approach that has historically afforded Indigenous peoples some small measure of cultural accommodation of certain kind of cultural traditions and languages, but at the expense of underlying title to the land. So these people are generally very critical of the process of extinguishing Aboriginal title in order to gain some small measure of cultural recognition. And so land back is a more radical position that is asserting underlying title and control to the earth as the primary objective of Indigenous politics, and a kind of no compromises approach to negotiation with colonial and corporate powers. That said, I mean, basically all of these movements, the broad social movements in which they're situated, are also in complex kinds of legal battles. So there are almost always some supplementary legal negotiation process that's going on at the same time, whether it's a treaty negotiation process or in Canada, there's the comprehensive land claims agreement, and as well as a special land claims process. So there's all these different other kinds of legal apparatus. They also include things like court challenges, litigation. And I mean, basically your question gets to this heart of this issue of what are the strengths and weaknesses of a legal negotiation process? The strengths, of course, are that the law is one of the primary institutional mechanisms by which these debates are settled. Law is almost impossible to avoid in some sense or another. The legal status of the ownership claim of one party or another is what allows for enforcement through usually very violent sort of state mechanisms, bringing in the police and whatnot. So law can't be avoided altogether. And I think that what this, for instance, this Maori negotiator, this Gerald Alberta, is talking about is the imperative of Indigenous peoples to try to find what he calls an approximation in law for their alternative visions of relating to the land. But it also has a downside, right? And the downside is that law is itself
a very asymmetrical terrain of struggle. The state obviously has enormous resources relative to the challengers. There's an enormous bent towards corporate rights over against the rights of the natural environment and natural world. And so there's kind of, law doesn't take it out of the realm of politics, but is it itself a realm of politics. It's a very particular way in which political struggles are contested. And it's a deeply asymmetrical one. And so there's always this problem of how are you going to leverage within the context of law power. The other kind of more abstract issue is the question of whether legal rights are, even in principle, the right way to think about these things. Law has a tendency, at least kind of more dominant forms of European law, have a tendency to try to think about political relationships as rights-based, that someone eventually has to, in a sense, possess the right to do this or that with this or that object. And so it's very subjective, in the subjective, not in the sense of being attached to a subject, a legal person who can have the status and standing of being the claimant. And it's very rights-based. And for lots of Indigenous peoples, that's just incompatible with their broader sense of duties and obligations. It's sort of moral responsibility. Our legal system is not as well equipped to think through those kinds of issues. And in particular, our legal system is not very well equipped to think about the duties and obligations and responsibilities that we owe to the non-human world, non-human life, the more than human, these rivers and ecosystems, the mountains and whatnot, have a kind of moral worth and moral standing that's not easily rendered visible in a legal form, because law ultimately requires a kind of claimant. Right, a legal person. And so there are these approximations, as the Maori negotiator puts it, to think of ways to get at these alternative ideas within a legal framework. One of those is to try to afford legal rights to non-human entities. In this case, a kind of whole ecosystem is given legal status as a person. We do this all the time with corporations. They are have legal personhood. So the idea of like an abstraction having a legal personhood standing isn't totally foreign to our traditions of law, but it's a little more unusual to think of like an ecosystem or an area, a river, a mountain, as itself being like a legal person. I would say that the question of will that succeed, right, is kind of where your question's headed, I think. And I think the answer to that is it depends entirely on our ability to build collective power outside of the legal system. The law is ultimately going to be responsive to our capacity to build broad-based social movements that can, in effect, actualize the legal rights in the way that we want. If we get legal decisions, but we don't have the broad social movements built in order to respond to those legal decisions, then it's almost certain that the legal decisions, how even if they come out kind of on paper in favor of the Indigenous people or in favor of, say, protection of the river, that very easily gets co-opted and just turned into another cycle of dispossession. So in other words, it's the law is a tool, but it's an ineffective one if it's not supplemented by broader social movement-based kinds of work that actually picks up where the law leaves off and in effect makes the law become what it is that we want it to be. So that's where I kind of try to end with the book, because I think that that's, you know, a great deal of the history of this stuff, as you mentioned, is pretty bleak, but I am convinced that Indigenous peoples have such a rich, deep tradition of thinking through these struggles and trying to build that, those kind of broad-based social movements, that they're really the ones who know how to do this, and the extensive study of their history, their political and intellectual history, is the key to understanding how we can do this more effectively going forward. Because really, you know, the whole future of the planet depends on our capacity to actualize these kind of deeper commitments and connections to the Earth.
Dr. Nichols, was there anything else you would like to add? And where can people find more of your work in addition to or beyond this, what I find crucial text that you've written?
Thank you for having me. And I don't think I have too much more to add. If people are interested, the only other thing I suppose I could mention is just that kind of partially as a putting you're putting my money where my mouth is, the book is open access. So the book is free to download for anybody who wants it. It's open access copyright. So if you are interested in the book and you're listening but you either can't afford to purchase it or have no kind of way of acquiring the book at the moment, you're more than welcome to just get it from Duke University Press. It's available on the website there.